New York City, the survival capital of the world. This is Radio Doomsday Live. I'm your host, Mike Luckman. My guest tonight is Lloyd Pye, who's keeper of the enigmatic Star Child skull. We're going to be talking about that with Lloyd and what his latest findings have been concerning DNA evidence that strongly suggests that this skull may be, in fact, part alien. We'll get back to that in just a few minutes. First, I wanted to make a few comments, though, having to do with the my latest discoveries. And this is something that's very, very disturbing. I touched on this on the last edition of Radio Doomsday Live. It has to do with the mysterious deaths of something like two dozen astronomers who apparently were murdered. There's no nice way of saying it. And what they all had in common was that they were researching near-Earth objects, meaning asteroids, comets, perhaps Planet X. And they found something that somebody didn't want known, and they were apparently silenced for this. Frankly, it's the most disturbing news that I've ever heard in my life, because being a follower of Zechariah Sitchin, the man who popularized Planet X, and just the last week we had Nancy Reeder on the show, and of course she has gotten a lot of press, not all of it favorable, for her research into Planet X and her claims that Planet X is on our doorstep. But one of the reasons we're talking so much about Planet X is, as you will see in a, in a matter of moments, Lloyd Pye's research very much follows in the footsteps of Zechariah Sitchin, who lives here in Manhattan, by the way. He died about 2 years ago. He was in his late 80s. But these apparent assassinations are very, very troubling, because one of the things that Planet X does, and I'm sure Lloyd will verify this as well, is that it hurls asteroids in the direction of Earth as it approaches. On its approach, this happens. And I'm afraid that this is what is happening right now while we're seeing so many asteroids. In fact, there's an asteroid that's due to come toward Earth actually below the satellites. That's how low it's going to be. The chances of it actually impacting, particularly on land on Earth, or even striking Earth at all, appear to be fairly remote. But nonetheless, it is something to watch. But these astronomers are obviously onto something. I think they're onto something major. And what's peculiar is that quite a number of them died in pairs. And if anyone knows about astronomers and how they work, they often work in teams like that in pairs. And they worked in pairs, lived in pairs, and died in pairs. So it's a very, very strange story, which I'll be continuing to follow. And I think that it's proof positive that Planet X is well on its way here and is getting perhaps dangerously close. It might be responsible for some of the weather problems that we've been having, to say the least. Now my guest, Lloyd Pye, he's a veteran researcher, author, and lecturer, and keeper of the Star Child skull, a skull which may be part human and part alien. And if it comes out, and so far all the preliminary tests indicate that it is real and that it does apparently contain alien DNA, it would represent the ultimate physical proof that Earth was visited in the past by extraterrestrials. I'd like to welcome you, Lloyd, to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you. It's an interesting time to be. They always say we live in interesting times. May we live in interesting times, and we do.
I wanted to ask you about the latest testing that you've done concerning this Star Child skull, which may in fact be part alien and part human. What can you tell us about the latest evidence and laboratory analysis?
Well, there have been several things. First of all, we have ongoing DNA analysis, and that really never stops. It doesn't go fast. It doesn't produce anything comprehensive. simply because the geneticist does that work mostly, for the most part, out of his own pocket, in his own time, mostly on weekends, because we can't get official support from anybody to, you know, to support it. And now, other on other fronts, we had a company called Medical Modeling in Golden, Colorado, which had done the original stereolithographic copies of the Star Child skull back in 99. They are now able to, were now able to use that, the same scans that they took back then, which were very sophisticated then, to create brain casts, what are called endocasts, of the brain from the inside of the skulls.
Right.
And so we have that now to compare to the brains, endocasts of human brains, and there's really not a comparison. Human brains are very folded, very knobby, very, we've all seen what human brains look like. The Star Child's brain is really virtually smooth in just all over, in all of its areas. It is smooth. It doesn't seem to have the convolutions that we have. Very, very different kind of brain. Also, there's been a very, very detailed scan of the Star Child bone at a Stanford Medical Center in Palo Alto, California, and that machine was able to essentially peel the Star Child skull like an onion, with each layer of the onion being of 5 to 10 molecule, not molecule, cells, 5 to 10 cells thick, trying to see what they could find about the fibers and the red residue, the fibers that are woven through the matrix of the bone.
Lloyd, how much additional time do you think it's going to take before you get to a stage where they can be final proof or something bordering on final proof? And how much money?
Well, as soon as we have the money, it's going to cost a lot. It costs several million to do it. Yeah, well, you know, you have to understand what you're up against to do it. But let's say that we can get the $3 million that is needed to do the recovery. That then from that point, it would take anywhere from 6 months to a year to have an answer laid out so airtight that the other side just can't argue with it. You have to understand what's being dealt with here, all right? You and I go into a lab, they draw some blood from us, they take some spit from us, they do whatever, you know, whatever you want to sample your own give. And when we go in a lab and we say, okay, we want our whole genome sequenced, whole entire genome, 3,200,000 base pair, nucleotide base pairs, more or less, you know, a little over 3 billion. That's going to cost about $10,000. Now, how can that be? Well, the first times they were doing it back when it first became possible with the 454 machines back in 2006, it was in the millions to do one. But the prices dropped dramatically as the technology has improved over those years. So now we're in like the third or fourth generation of those machines, and they're very sophisticated. So now what people need to understand is the difference between living fresh DNA, which could be mine or yours if we took it in, and it would be $10,000 to do our whole genome, and what's called ancient DNA, which is after 50 years, and the Star Child is 900 years old. In that time, any period of extended death, where you've been dead for a long time, all of the cells and the genome in the cells breaks into little pieces, just disintegrates, just really disintegrates. All the pieces are still there laying on the floor, but it's as if the genome...
I would think that some institutions, have you been approached by any institutions, scientists that are interested in, given the fact that it is so peculiar and that it does show some initial signs that it could in fact be what we think it is, have you been approached by any of those guys? And if so, who are they?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have We have it laid out. You can't tell you who they are, but we do have it. We have a connection with one of the top genetics labs in this country, and it really just comes down to the money. We're talking a lot of money, and
let me finish explaining
why, and it's important to understand why it's so expensive. All right, to recover the Star Child's DNA, it's as if my DNA or your DNA had been put through a wood chipper, and it's laying on the floor like pieces of glitter. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about base pair strings in the range of 50, 30, 10, 20, 50, 100, 200, 300, 500, bits and pieces and chips of the 3 billion. All of that has to be recovered chip by chip, and each chip has to find its place in the genome. So you can't just do it on one run through. You'll find a piece here, a piece there, a piece here, a piece there, and you'll find a bunch of the little pieces, but you don't really know exactly where they fit. You have to do anywhere from 50 to 100 runs, where you got to just do one for you and me. You'll have to do 50 to 100, and you'll put the results of each of those runs in a computer, and when you feel like you have enough you want to take a look at, you do what's called a compression. You know, you do a compression program. And you squeeze all of those 50, let's say, down into one. And you take every run, the results of every run. Well, let's say in 10 of those runs, you have the same piece each time repeated. And so that those 10 are going to produce one string in the final one. Well, after you've done 50 in the final, you take a look, you might have only 80% of the genome right there. So you're going to have to keep going at it to try to fill in that 80%. So in order to get the whole thing, it is extremely labor-intensive. The cost of each run is anywhere from, $750 to $15,000, depending on the kits that you're using and the reagents that you're using and all that. It's extremely expensive. So,
take us back to the time when you first discovered or came in contact with the Star Child skull, which I guess was your name. Back in 1999 when you met this couple in El Paso.
Right. That's it. Well, that's it. The skull had come into their possession. Ray and Melanie Young, and Melanie had been a neonatal nurse for about 15 years. And as soon as she saw it, she knew it wasn't neither a human. Everyone up until that point that had dealt with it, they had just been ordinary people without any specialized skills. Or knowledge, and they all just assumed it was some kind of weirdly deformed human. And
came into their possession, Lloyd, how did they come to have that skull? Do we know anything about where it was found?
Yeah, it was found in Mexico in about 1930, and the woman who found it was a teenager at that time, and so she found two skeletons. One was normal human. And then the other one was what turned it out to be the Star Child. So she just thought it was a deformed human, and she kept the skulls her whole life as souvenirs of the trip to Mexico. And that was pretty much it. Kept them in a cardboard box in her garage, and that was it. When she found out she was dying, she passed them on to friends in El Paso. They kept the cardboard box for another 5 years, and then passed it on to Ray and Melanie. And Melanie recognized that it wasn't a human deformity, that it was, in fact, something else. And it so happened that she and her husband, Ray, were members of El Paso MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, so he knew about aliens and what aliens look like. So she decided that it had all the physical hallmarks of a gray alien, and it does. It's absolutely all the physical hallmarks of a gray alien. And none of a human. I mean, none. There are 25. You can name 25 major points of reference on a human skull, and not one of those points matches exactly to the Star Child. Not one.
Okay. So this is, if this matches a gray alien, or at least we think it does.
Right.
It's not obviously. It's not related to the Anunnaki, or is it?
Well, if it's not related to the Anunnaki as we understand the Anunnaki, because the Anunnaki that Sitchin writes about and that seems to be written about in the Sumerian texts look like us. We are made in their image.
Right.
Exactly.
So there are the other kinds of Sumerian individuals that are written about called the Igigi, the I-G-I-G-I, the Igigi,
mm-hmm.
watchers
right.
to stay off planet.
Right.
Now, could be that the Star Child represents one of those. That's
right.
a possibility. The Coneheads could also represent those, or they could be represented by the Coneheads. We're not sure.
Well,
all I know is that the Star Child is not a Conehead.
That's for sure. Okay. What would you give the odds of this thing really, in fact, having alien DNA? What would your guesstimate on it be, percentage-wise?
Like 99%. I mean, I'm convinced.
Really?
I started out first year skeptical. I don't have any doubt, really. We've recovered enough bits and pieces of its DNA
right.
that matter. And every time we do that, the pieces show that they are completely different than the similar pieces in human DNA. Like, we're picking up those little pieces of glitter. Well, every time we find a piece of glitter that we can associate with some functioning part of the human genome, it has a corollary in the human genome. Understand, I remember, 97% of the human genome is considered junk DNA. It works, but they don't know what it does. So there's no function on record to compare it to. So when you pick up the pieces of glitter, if they're in the junk, they're not doing you any good. Our geneticist has recovered a lot of the junk. It doesn't do him any good. So every once in a while, he gets piece from out of the working 3%, and he can then compare directly, bit to bit, by the human genome. And when he does that, and when he finds those pieces, every time he compares them, they are radically, wildly different from the human. I mean, radically different, wildly different. A chimp is 97%, its genome is 90% the same as ours. A gorilla is 95% the same. A rat is 70%. A mouse is 65%. Yeast, plain old common yeast, is like 20% the same as the human genome.
Okay.
Everything there is earthbound. The Star Child, compared to a human, it looks like it's going to be several hundred percent different. So the argument is, well, does that represent alien DNA? Well, of course it does. Of course it does. But, of course, you're going to have the mainstream trying to say, well, just because it's that different doesn't mean it's alien. It just means it's another weird kind of human. And we're going to have that battle over who do you believe, me or your lying eyes kind of thing, you know.
Okay.
The woman comes in, catch her husband in bed with another woman, and he says, it's not what it seems. Well, yeah, you're going to believe me or your lying eyes. It is what it is, yeah.
Right.
So
let's talk a minute about your books. Of course, there's one, Star Child's Skull, which I guess you've had for a while, and then Intervention Theory, which challenges traditional theories of creationism, intelligent design, and evolution. Explain to my audience, if you would, the basic idea of creationism, intelligent design, evolution most people are familiar with.
Well, evolution, everybody knows what Darwinian evolution is.
Absolutely.
The lightning bolt came down and struck the warm pool with the molecules in it that somehow swirled themselves into a living thing, and it all started from there. And it's just it's a fairy tale, just a complete fairy tale. That didn't happen. And
Right. Everybody
knows what creationism is, that, God came down and swept something into life, you know. Again, fairy tales. It's just it's all fairy tales, and it's just a question of what fairy tale you want to believe, you choose to believe. What I believe is that everything is here on Earth is done through intervention, that there's nothing here that just happens. It isn't intelligent design. It's intervention by beings that I call terraformers. We're not talking about the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki come later. The terraformers, I think the Earth itself has been terraformed from day one. And this is what I talk about in my ebook, Intervention Theory Essentials. And I go over what I consider blindingly clear and obvious proof that this is true. Because in the mechanics of space, if you have a seething ball of magma that supposedly the Earth was in the beginning, and it's just cruising along through the frigid, freezing temperatures of space, the only thing that can happen is that as that seeding ball of magma loses its heat and it hardens, it just turns into a cold, dead rock, which most of the things you look at in space, that's pretty much what they are, just either hot, dead rocks or cold, if they have an atmosphere, or cold, dead rocks if they don't. But that's pretty much what they are. Earth is very, very, very unique from all we can tell, from all we can see. Earth is very unique. How did that happen? Well, it happened that way because it had to be made that way. It couldn't just happen. Earth is created to be what it is from 4.5 billion years ago. Certain things have to happen. Certain things have to happen on a schedule. Certain things have to happen, and one thing has to happen, and then another thing has to happen, and then another thing has to happen, and they have to happen in that order. And they have to happen at certain times. And if any of that is off, the whole thing falls apart. So
okay, Lloyd,
how does it all magically work? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say if indeed the Star Child skull is found to be part extraterrestrial, and I assume that at that point you would go public even further and hold a news conference, and that would be covered by, I'm sure, all the world's media. What would you do with the skull then?
Well, it would end up in one of the major museums of the world, obviously, and somebody that could protect it, it would then become one of the most valuable things in the world, and it would have to be protected as such, and I think only a major museum could do that.
Have you taken any precautions as far as security involving that skull? Because
sure.
If it is anything even close to what you're saying,
I know.
Somebody could just fetch that, and that's,
it stays
that's
in
the
bank.
End of it.
It stays in a bank vault.
In a bank vault,
yeah.
Good place for it, I guess.
Yeah, it's the best place I can come
I guess.
With. Yeah,
exactly. It sounds pretty secure to me. So, ladies and gentlemen, Lloyd Pye, the keeper of the Star Child's skull, you may know very well know his name because he wrote some years ago a very popular book called Everything You Know Is Wrong, and that book incorporates some of Zechariah Sitchin's ideas and has become an overnight, became an overnight sensation. What can you tell us, a few anecdotes from that book?
Well, the book does indeed, in part four, deal with Zechariah's work, and it's sort of like the cliff notes to his work. I don't know if you've ever tried to read any of his stuff, but
yes,
it's a little dense for a lot of people. And so what I tried to do was boil it down and give the essence of his work in part four of Everything You Know Is Wrong, and that was one of the reasons that it became popular. But also, it has four parts. The first part is this, you know, the beginning, the intervention stuff. I have a lot more of the intervention, more updated intervention stuff in Intervention Theory Essentials, the ebook. But that's what part one was about. Part two and part three dealt with hominoids, and really, it's more of a hominoid book than it is a Sitchin book. But hominoids are Bigfoot, the abominable snowman, and all that, and it's an explanation to people for why they're out there, how they're out there, how they can be there and everybody thinks they're not there, on and on, and it deals with those issues in considerable detail. And
Boy,
so,
do you really think, I have a bit of a problem, I always have had a bit of a problem with Bigfoot, and admittedly, because of my bias against Bigfoot, I have really not done any reading or spent any time on the subject, so I'll admit that out front, but nonetheless...
Sure, a lot of people feel
that
way.
You say Bigfoot to people. What is the evidence? What is the best evidence that you're aware of the existence of Bigfoot? Because we know that there's certainly been some films that were very well publicized through the years that are obvious hoaxes or appear to be.
The best evidence is, in terms of film, is it's still the Patterson-Gimlin film. Absolutely authentic. I don't care what you say. I mean, I don't care what you hear from anybody. The Roger Patterson, Bob Gimlin film is legitimate. All you have to do is look at the very slow motion, up close films of it, and those are there. And you can see her muscles rippling under her skin. No, it's not. Well, if it was a guy in a suit, why would you put those big, heavy, pendulous breasts on it? And then why would those breasts sway so perfectly, exactly like flesh breasts sway, instead of some kind of phony, you know, silicone type, whatever they would have done? Why go to the trouble? If you're going to make a suit, why make a suit with the breasts? But the, well, but why, the point of it is why, you can see the muscles rippling.
Lloyd, how many years ago is that? Tell us a little bit about the origin of that film. When was it? When was that film made?
The fall of 1967. Yeah, in the fall of 1967, where you couldn't. There was no photoshopping. There was no fooling around then.
Where was the Bigfoot?
At Bluff Creek, California. Yeah, and they were just out. You know, riding, and they had the camera. Both of them were, and Bob had the rifle. And the deal was, if we spot one, you know, if we should spot anything, Roger said, I'll try to film it, but you back me up if there's any problem, shoot it. And so, if it was somebody in a suit, you know, some kind of a fake, they were risking it, but it isn't. I mean, don't even think about a suit for that one. That one was absolutely legitimate. It left tracks that are very readable in a very hard packed sand bar. It left tracks that indicated a weight of a minimum around 600 pounds and probably in the range of 800 pounds. Everything about that stacks up. There's also the Minnesota Iceman, which I saw with my own eyes. And the Minnesota Iceman was a dead hominoid that had been shot and killed and put frozen into a block of ice. And that was taken around all over the country for about 10 years by a guy named Frank Hansen, who had a rubber mold copy made of it, so that every time he would be reported as maybe having killed some kind of a being, and the FBI or anybody would come and to examine it, he'd show them the rubber model, and he'd go out with the real one and continue to make his money.
The Anunnaki were also very tall. And what would the relationship be of the Anunnaki to some of these other reported tall beings in various periods in our history?
Well, the Bigfoot-type hominoid, there are four different types of hominoid based on size. The giant kind, the 8 to 10 foot tall, are the Bigfoot Sasquatch kind. But there are two other different man-sized kind, the Abominable Snowman, Yeti, everybody's heard of that one from the Himalayas. What you haven't heard of are the Almas and the Kaptars that are dominant in Russia, in the Caucasus and other mountain ranges in Russia, but in other places around the world as well, including the U.S., with the skunk ape here in Florida and other places. And then you have the pygmy kind that are found in the jungles that circle the equator of the world, the Ogogways and Tsedapas, what are now currently known as the Hobbits. They found a skeleton of one, and they've had all kinds of trouble shoehorning it into some kind of human form, but in reality, that the Hobbit, what is known as the Hobbit from Indonesia, is just an Ogogwe Sedapa type hominoid.
What has the public reaction been, and how much support have you been getting for this campaign to raise funds for the further testing in the Star Child skull?
Well, we don't get a lot of help with that, frankly, because it has to come from somebody that's wealthy. And wealthy people, as a rule, seem, at least as I interact with them, seem to have a belief system that if something like this was real, they would already know about it, that it would be talked about in mainstream media. And so their reaction always is, How can I believe you and science says it's not true? I'm not going to put money behind something that science says is not real and not true.
Yeah, it's too bad that Lawrence Rockefeller still isn't alive. Of course, he supported the White House initiative and this report called The Best Available Evidence About UFOs. And he just might have been the right guy to...
He could well have been. But, you know, there are people out there that are, you know, wealthy people who are known to support these kinds of causes. Paul Allen comes to mind because he did the funding for SETI, for the you know, for the antenna out there that are trying to hear things. So Paul Allen would be perfect if we could get connected to Paul Allen, but we've tried that on a number of occasions. He's difficult to get to. So he would be probably at the top of the list.
Right.
But, you know what we're up against.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're interested in finding out more about this project, just go to www.starchildproject.com where there's much further information. And if you want to get in touch with Lloyd and see his writings and his learn more about his research, go to www.lloydpye.com. Okay, Lloyd, we're going to be back in a minute. Oh, before we go, I just wanted to ask you about your reaction on hearing this news. Have you heard this before about the astronomers who met these mysterious deaths, so many of them, about two dozen in all, over the last several years in various parts of the world, including, by the way, Gene Shoemaker, the co-discoverer of the Shoemaker-Levy comet, who died in a car accident. They said that he was driving drunk, and the next day his laboratory burned to the ground. So it really is very distressing news to me. I just wonder if you've heard about this situation before.
No, I had not. No, it's not something that, you know.
What is your reaction upon
it? Well, I'd have to be honest with you. I'd have to really check that out thoroughly because there's so many quote conspiracy theories that come out on the internet that when you really look under the covers and see what the truth of it is, they don't stand up at all. So I'm not saying that it didn't happen. I'm saying that I would not be comfortable, you know, saying that I verified it in any way.
Because I'm in the process of
doing. But if it was true, then yeah, if it was true, it would be concerning, of course.
Yeah. How far away do you think Planet X may be?
I don't think it's anywhere in the ballpark. I really don't agree with Nancy at all. I think what my understanding of it, and this was pretty much Zechariah's as well, is that it's not due for another probably 1,500 years from now. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, let's just be logical about it. If there was any planetary-sized body within striking range of this solar system that had the size and the albedo, which is the brightness factor that the Planet X or Nibiru is supposed to have,
right,
there is a literal army, and I mean an army, thousands of, quote, amateur astronomers who are amateur in name only. They have very sophisticated equipment, and they're scouring the night skies every single night, all around 24 hours a day. So somewhere in the world, there are dozens of telescopes turned on the sky with one goal in mind, to spot that next little blip of light out there that's going to turn into the next comet that's going to be named after them. It's just a hobby for these people, but they're very serious about it. So there's nothing that's going to sneak up on us, guys. There's just nothing like that.
Well, you know, of course, there have been photos. I mean, they're not necessarily convincing photos, but there have been photos that have been taken by amateur astronomers, and people claim that it's being blocked by the sun. Some of those photos, many of them actually show what's called the second sun, two suns, basically.
The question I would ask is how did it sneak up behind the sun, and then how does it stay behind the sun?
Right.
Is it guided?
We just don't know the answer to that, do we? We just do not know the answer.
No. There is no answer to that. There is no answer. It didn't happen. That's where the answer is. That didn't happen.
Well, you know, Sitchin, I believe, said, I'm pretty sure that he said, actually, that it would be, he thought that it would be coming perhaps maybe 50 years, 60 years from now. There's a big factor that comes in here, Lloyd, and that is that the neither of us are physicists, but the fact that that planet moves the way that it does, it also its path is the speed is erratic. So it's almost impossible, or it is impossible, really, to be able to know exactly when it might arrive.
Well, its speed is not as erratic because it has an orbit, supposedly, of 3,600 years,
yes,
give or take a few years, but not, you know, that's not a radical difference. Also, all this hinges on it being the Star of Bethlehem. If indeed we consider that it's the Star of Bethlehem, that about 2,000 years ago is when the Anunnaki left from their isolated position in the Sinai. If, again, we assume all these things that are what Sitchin came to conclude after his years of research with it, then if Nibiru was indeed the Star of Bethlehem at about 2,000 years ago from now, that gives another 1,600 years. So let's just shave it down a little bit and call it 1,500 years from now. And
well,
if it's 1,500 years out there,
if you want to look at it from that perspective, I'm not sure that I do. Are you familiar with the third secret of Fatima?
Yeah, I know that there was a secret, and I know that supposedly it was told, but that's another one of those that I'm not sure about the conspiracy end of it. I've heard pro and con on that, and I frankly don't know who to believe, because when you hear a pro and a con, then you don't. It becomes really hard to know.
Well, you know, Pope John Paul II, before he died, many years before he died, he was in Germany, and he was asked by some Catholic pilgrims, why doesn't the church put this information out? And answering their question, he more or less let the cat out of the bag. He said, if from one moment to the next, if there was something that was so terrible was going to happen, that from one moment to the next, millions of people could drown in the oceans, then it wouldn't be make any sense for the church to allow that information out. It would just serve the cause of sensationalism. Now, we also have the fact that Father Malachy Martin, in numerous appearances on the Art Bell Show on Coast to Coast, finally said that it was that had to do with a bolide or a comet, something like that, or Planet X, if you will, coming toward Earth and causing unthinkable destruction. Now, the time frame that he put on it was kind of vague, and that window is passed. That doesn't mean, however, that it's not there. Furthermore, Lloyd, you might be interested in knowing that I've been very close with some of the Mayan elders in both Mexico and in Guatemala, and including the Mayan guy who's considered to be the Mayan Pope. In any event, some of the Mayan leaders strongly feel that Planet X comes around every 3,600 years. So there is that Mayan angle. And further, there's a professor at the University of Professor Emeritus, Mike Bailey, at the University of Belfast, I've been in touch with. And he found something very interesting. He found out that that using ice core samples, that comet strikes appear to correspond to Mayan calendar endings. So there we have that same thing happening over and over and over again, the possibility, I think a pretty strong possibility, that Planet X is not that far off. I can't say how long, how many years away, but it's not perhaps not that far off.
Well, I mean, we're all entitled to our opinions. My opinion is that it's not even in the ballpark, and nothing else is either in terms of planetary-sized objects. But in terms of a bolide or a comet or something a mile or two across, that on the equivalent of what scale of what took out the dinosaurs, that's certainly possible. That could sneak up on us because that wouldn't have much albedo. That wouldn't be easy to see, even for the astronomers. We might only get a week or two warning, maybe, with that, or a month or two warning. There's nothing
right
we could do. If we're the bullseye of something like that, it's just lean over and kiss it goodbye.
So you don't think that all the severe weather that we've been experiencing, which is the worst really in our lifetime, is in any way, shape, or form connected to the approach of of Planet X?
No, I just think that's global warming, period. I don't see that at all.
Okay.
I do agree the weather's changing, but I do think it's global warming.
Okay, you think it's global warming. Okay.
Yep.
All right, Lloyd, before we wrap up, I would like to hear some more from you about the Anunnaki. What would you, if the Anunnaki landed tomorrow, openly landed, what would you want to talk to them about? How would you communicate them? Assuming that you could communicate back and forth, what would your message to them be?
Well, I think
I'm
probably
you on the spot here. Not
no,
everyone's
it's,
prepared.
You know, yes. It's understandable. That's a good question, and I don't know if there would be one simple, easy answer. I think the thing that most of us would want to know from the Anunnaki is, how do we get here? It's clear we don't belong here. It's clear we don't fit this planet. What's the truth about how we got here? If they created us, was the story as written true? Was there a big debate? Was it a close call? What are we doing here? And then I think probably question number two would be, what do you know, or how much do you know about first cause? How did it all really start? Not the business about the lightning bolt hitting into the
right
warm pool. You know, not the ridiculous stuff of science and religion. What's the truth? What's the truth about first cause? I'd certainly want to know those two things. How did we really get here? What's the truth of that? And to what extent do they know the truth about first cause? And they may not know. They may not know. Mm-hmm. So
did you ever meet Zechariah Sitchin?
Say again?
Did you ever meet Zechariah Sitchin?
Yes, I knew him quite well. I was with him on his first three tours that he took around the world, and then I met him on a number of other occasions and spent time with him, and I considered him a good friend.
Give my listeners an idea of what he was like personally. I mean, I knew him a little bit, but I'm curious as your impression of him and you know, some of your experiences with him.
Well, I assume everybody knows he was born in Russia, so he still spoke with a fairly heavy accent. That he was a very cautious man. He didn't give away his friendship very easily. He had to get very, very comfortable with you. He had to spend a lot of time with you.
Right.
He had one of the driest senses of humor I think I've ever met. He had a very, very dry sense of humor.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Funny. He was funny. He really was very witty, quick with a quip, but it had a little dry twist on it in a way that, you know, we were all impressed. But another thing that impressed me about him, probably the most, because when I was meeting him, I was just starting on the path leading me to where I am now. And I remember in the first trip, I had read all of his first three books again at that time, The 12th Planet, The Stairway to Heaven, and The Wars of Gods and Men. And at that time, I was probably 45, 46, 47, somewhere in there. I still had a really, really good memory. And he was talking in one of the lectures. He would give these lectures as we were going to go someplace. And in one of the lectures, he said something about one of the movements of one of the moons. It was a complex little issue, but he had it wrong. What he said was wrong. So I didn't say anything then. And on the bus, as we were going to the place, I went up to him from my seat and I said, you know, you said this in that lecture back there, and the way it is in the book is this. And he said, really? And I said, yes. And he said, could you show me that? And so I said, I believe I can. So I went back and I got the book and I looked up the passage and I brought it to him and I showed it to him. He read it. He would push his glasses up on his head to read. He was nearsighted, so he could see perfectly without his glasses. So he pushed his glasses up on his head and he read it. And he pushed his glasses back down and he looked up at me and he smiled and he said, I stand corrected.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, there was no BS about, right. Well, I really meant, you know, he didn't try to talk his way out of it. Didn't need to. He had just made, you know, a million errors, and he can't, you know, I mean, a million things he says, and he makes one little error that I was aware of. I mean, what a record, you know, really, if you look at it that way. But the, what impressed me so much was that there was no hemming and hawing and trying to backtrack or anyway trying to excuse himself. He just said, I stand corrected. Like, yeah, basically saying to me, good job, you know. And yeah, I appreciate it.
Zechariah, you know, people criticize him, notably Sumerian scholars, has said that he just got it plain wrong, that he really wasn't that adept at the at being able to translate the Sumerian language, and that he misinterpreted all over the place. I don't happen to agree with that, but what do you think of people?
Well, I mean, I can tell you exactly what the problem is. Those quote scholars, and a lot of them are not scholars at all, but the ones who criticize him, particularly Michael Heiser, they're all complaining that what he did, that he didn't have the authority, that he had no right to try to change the classic definitions, the classic interpretations of the Sumerian tablet. But what nobody points out is that those tablets were translated back from, let's just say, in roundabout numbers, 1850 to 1950, in that 100-year period, right? And so when those were being translated, there was no such thing as aliens. There was no such thing as UFOs. Not heard of. Okay? Not understood by anybody. So those guys doing those initial translations, when they were reading things that looked and sounded like UFOs and aliens, they didn't know what to say. They didn't know what to call it. So they didn't have a cubbyhole. I mean, a pigeonhole to put it in. So they just made stuff up to make it fit the world that they understood and called it myth and things like that. So what Sitchin did when he got to the point, and this is from him, when he got to the point where he could read it and could understand it, he would go in looking for what the classic thing, the interpretation said, and he would realize, wait a minute, that's not what they're saying. That's not what they're saying at all. And then he started realizing that so much of what they were interpreted to say was not what they were saying at all. And so the problem
Somebody you mentioned, Lloyd, Michael Heiser. Is he the guy with the
website? Yeah, Michael Heiser's the guy. Yeah, he has the site that says Sitchin was wrong.
Yeah,
and you
right.
See a lot
SitchinWasWrong.com, yeah.
Yeah, Sitchin was wrong. And Heiser's just a fundamentalist Christian that has a very, very sharp axe to grind against Zechariah because of that. So anyway, but I just ask everybody to keep in mind the classic translations that Heiser and all the others support and defend were created by people who had no understanding and no acceptance of UFOs and aliens, and the difference in Zechariah's translations is that he does. Just that simple.
What Lloyd, since you feel that the Star Child skull comes from a stereotypical gray alien, what do you think about the grays, particularly their involvement with abductions of individuals? Apparently, there are hundreds of thousands of people all across the world, really, who have had reported these kinds of experiences. What do you think that they're doing? Do you think they're doing these abductions? If they are, what do you think their motive might be? And
I don't understand why this would be the case, but this is what I think. Everything that people say about this is that these are, for the most part, the ones who are returned to Earth, to their homes and their lives, there's a sexual element involved. They are being harvested. The women, females are being harvested of their eggs. Men are being harvested of sperm. And so something is going on in terms of reproduction of human-like beings, or human beings rather, in another place. So what probably is, it all means, in my opinion, is there must be a planet out there where beings like us live, but for whatever reason, they're a hybrid type that can't reproduce. And so our sperm and our eggs are part of that reproduction process for that planet. And they haven't either for a reason, they don't want to, or they haven't figured out how to make those people fertile so that they can reproduce in the way that we do. Maybe that planet has some environment that prevents them from being able to reproduce themselves. I don't know. That's all, and that's just a pure guess, understand. I just look at the facts, and I look at what seems to be going on, and humans are being abducted here on a very regular basis. They are being sampled. Their eggs and sperm are being taken from them. You know, the anal probes that everybody makes such fun of with the men, that's just sperm being removed. That's all that is.
First thing that happens to most abductees, they report that they're being teleported basically outside, through a closed window in some cases, in their apartment,
right.
or even
right.
taken from a car, which suggests another body type of experience, an interdimensional kind of experience, and yet they're talking about, you know, physical, and you're talking about physical manifestations, the harvesting of hybrids.
I know how unlikely it sounds and seems, but you have the famous Travis Walton story, you have the Barney and Betty Hill story, things that are really, really backed up with a lot of evidence, like the Patterson film, like the Minnesota Iceman, like the Xana story, which we didn't really talk about. But there are some certain cases that are so strong in their evidence that if you have to take those serious, then you have to take all of them serious.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. There are lots of, a surprising number, really, of UFO abductees in the New York metropolitan area. I've met dozens of them, and they're absolutely sane. And it's obvious to me quite profound has happened to them. That's totally turned their life upside down in some cases.
Right.
But
well, did you know Bud Hopkins? Did you talk to Bud?
I did. Yeah, I did. I did know Bud Hopkins, and what's the David? Temple University
Jacobs,
professor.
Jacobs.
I met Jacobs on a couple of occasions. We were together on the Geraldo show. I followed all that. I read their books, and I know Whitley Strieber, and I followed his experiences. So there's no doubt that something tremendous is happening. What it all boils down to, what it all means, is hard to say. But anyhow, Lloyd, I would like to thank you very much for being a guest on Radio Doomsday Live. I'd like to have you back sometime soon. And ladies and gentlemen, my guest is Lloyd Pye, the keeper of the Star Child Skull. And you can get in touch with Lloyd and find out what his current projects are by going to www.LloydPye.com, and also by going to the StarChildProject.com. Thanks very much. This is Mike Luckman signing off. Until next time.
That's great. It starts with a